warm-up is complete. We've had the open test at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to begin the month. We've had road course racing over the weekend. Now it's nearly time for the main event, or at least the preliminaries to the main event. Indianapolis 500 practice begins tomorrow, 11 a.m. is when the track will be open for veterans for the first 2 hours, rookies in the middle of the day, and refreshers for veterans not full-time last year, and then all in the afternoon from 3 until 6. Good evening, I'm Kevin Lee. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 107.5, 1070 The Fan, in the studio for the day, because no activity in the track today, but back out at IMS tomorrow. Donald Davidson is here. Hello, Donald. How are you?
I'm fine, Kevin. I didn't go to the track yesterday. It was a day off.
You were not allowed. You were encouraged not to. I think you probably could have gotten in, but the track was closed. The garage was closed. Teams were not allowed to go. They were all back out early this morning, though, prepping and getting ready for practice tomorrow.
I had a lie-in yesterday. It's been a while.
I was at the go-kart track at 8 a.m., And Saturday was much more rewarding financially than Sunday was. That's the way it seems to go. All right, let's get into it. 317-239-1070. Questions for Donald. Full phone lines. When someone hangs up, that's your cue to call. Jeff in Indianapolis is up first tonight. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, this is Jeff. I'm calling Donald to hear you talk about my wife's late husband was Gary Moore, Lou's oldest son. And I wanted to talk about his, you know, his driving and ownership career.
And who was that again? I didn't get the name.
Lou Moore.
Oh, Lou Moore. Yes. Okay. Sorry. I didn't. There was a little distortion. I didn't hear it.
And he was asking about his son. Gary, right? Is that what you said, Jeff?
Well, yeah. Gary was the oldest son. Yes.
But you want to hear about Lou Moore?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that unless I misunderstood your question.
Yep, you're good.
Yeah, all right, very good. Well, Lou Moore was a driver-turned-car owner. That's the short version. He was very successful as a driver, although he did not win, but he was a runner-up and also third twice, and we can go a little bit more to it because there's more to it than that. He also won the pole in 32, but he became a very successful car owner. In the later years, he drove his own cars and then had people drive for him, and then at some point decided that maybe he would do better as an owner and manage teams, which he did with, he was the master strategist, so I'm probably doing this in the wrong order. He started racing in 1923. First year at the Speedway was 1928, and he finished second with Louis Schneider as a relief driver. And then in 1929, he almost got second again, this time with a driver named Barney Klepfer. And they broke down with two laps to go, running second. And in those days, it wasn't like now where breaking down with a couple of laps to go would still get you a top 10 finish, maybe. But back then, they kept the race going, and so he slid further and further down the list. But 1932, he had the pole, as they say. 1933, he finished third with the Foreman Axle Special. And then in 1934, this was really, for those days, quite a an undertaking. There was a road race in Algeria called the Tripoli Grand Prix, Northern Africa, but not very far from Italy, as it turns out. But for any American that wanted to go, and a couple of them did, it was quite a trek. And so he drove in the Tripoli Grand Prix in the early part of May, and then in the Indianapolis 500, but with the same car. And so while the early part of practice and qualifying was going on, he wasn't even here, but back in time and to qualify for the 34 500 and then finish in third place with the Foreman Axle Special. And then he was a DNF in 35 and 36. And that was at the point where he decided that he would just outfield other drivers. In 1938, Floyd Roberts drove for him and won the race. And so he became, it was sort of a Michael Andretti thing. He did not win as a driver, but he won as an owner. And then, pardon me, in 1940, he got a third with, 39 was unfortunately Floyd Roberts, who was the defending 500 winner and national champion, lost his life in an accident coming out of turn two. But Frank Wern, in the other car that Floyd Roberts, of which Floyd Roberts was a part owner and also worked on the cars, which is one of the reasons why Lou Moore really liked Floyd Roberts, because Lou Moore would do a lot of his own mechanical work, and Floyd Roberts was into that without a lot of publicity, because it wasn't that unusual then. But he got really down into it, and I've seen a couple of photographs with him with a driver's uniform on, and he's just covered from head to foot with grease, and the sleeves are rolled up as he's, you know, reaching in to, you know, change a rear end or do something with the rear axle. Anyway, that was a huge loss. But Frank Wern in the other car finished ninth, and then in 1940, Maury Rose was third. And then in 41, there was a three-car team and Lou Moore. And he had acquired a Maserati, just very similar to the one that Wilbur Shaw had driven to victory in 39 and 40. That's what everybody wanted. And Maury Rose drove the Maserati that Lou Moore had acquired. And Cliff Brazier drove a more standard car. The one that Frank Wern had driven the year before. And then the Maury Rose car was driven by Floyd Davis. And Lou Moore was a master strategist, and in no particular order here. Some people would go through the two-event approach, which was to try and win the pole, go as fast as you can to qualify as fast as you could, and then lean it back for the race. Well, what he did was he never was really that concerned about qualifying, because his whole attention was on the 500 miles. And then also a little bit later on, when he wouldn't use nitro to qualify, which some people were doing because they'd run faster, and he would use, instead of using exotic fuels, he ran, well, I believe it was avgas. I mean, it wasn't pump gasoline, but he used fuel that got a lot better mileage, and he was happy to sit out there, have his drivers sit out there, and typically make one stop, which is and it's been a while. Anyway, so the plan was that Cliff Brazier was not going to stop at all. They had a huge tank, and then I don't know what was planned for the 1940 Maury Rose car. Anyway, Rose was on the pole with the Maserati, and broke down early, at about 60 laps. And then the Floyd Davis car was not up to where Lou Moore thought it should be. And so they brought Floyd Davis in, took him out, and put Maury Rose in. And by which time, I think the car was around 12th. And so late in the race, with Maury Rose coming up through the field, Wilbur Shaw was leading with the Maserati. Cliff Brazier was second, quite a distance behind, running at a slower pace, but trying to get through the whole thing with no stops at all. And Rex Mays had to make a pit stop because he had a supercharged engine, and I think he had to make three stops. And then up gaining fast was Rose. So Rex Mays made a stop. Wilbur Shaw had a right rear wheel collapse at 152 laps. And so into the lead went Cliff Brazier, but Maury Rose was catching. And one of the reasons that Brazier was slowing down was he was starting to become ill from the fumes. And so at one point they came down the straightaway side by side with Rose taking over the lead, and he went on to win. And then Cliff Brazier faded to fifth at the end. Anyway, that was a second victory for Lou Moore. In 40, six, he did not enter a car, but Cliff Brashear had purchased the car that he had driven in 41. And so Lou Moore went with him as sort of the pit manager and so on and so forth. Anyway, 47 and 48 and 49 and 50, we had the Blue Crown spark plug specials. And famously, with low sitting front drive cars, Maury Rose and Bill Holland finished first and second. Holland, who was a rookie, a 39-year-old rookie, led much of the way. And late in the race, while he was leading with Rose about 30 seconds behind, came the controversy, as the Brits would call it, when Lou Moore thought, I've got the two cars are far ahead of everybody else now, so we can slow them down. And so no two-way radios, you know, no spotters. All they could do was to give the drivers signals by writing brief messages on a chalkboard. And so both of the drivers were shown the easy sign, which was EZY or EZY if you're a Brit, which meant just slow down. And so Holland, in the race for the first time, leading, sees that and slows down. And crafty Maury Rose saw it about 30 seconds later and did not slow down. And so during the next few laps, Rose caught up with Holland, passed him with seven laps to go. Holland waved him by, thinking that Rose was just unlapping himself and didn't realize what the situation was. And so Rose went on to a victory that was not very popular with some of the fans. And the question was, why didn't they advise Holland that Rose was catching him up? And then that Rose and Moore were in cahoots and had ganged up on the new boy. And Lou Moore's explanation when it was over was that he'd signaled both drivers to slow down, but when Holland slowed down and Rose didn't, it wasn't going to make any difference to him because his cars were going to finish first and second anyway, and he didn't want them to get into a battle racing with each other. So I had the opportunity to talk to both drivers about it later, and I thought the Maury Rose angle, I remember he sat in my office at USAC, and he said, I didn't have a deal with Moore like that. He said, everybody thought we were in cahoots and we weren't. He said, I'm a professional race driver. And he said, I was down to where I was running the 500 only and an engineer the rest of the year. And my part of my living was off prize money, and first happened to pay more than second. And he said, so when we got the signal, I decided to keep going and see what happened. And he said, it got to the point where I'd come out of turn four. I could see Holland going through turn one. And so I kept the pace up, and they said I caught him, and then I passed him, and then I kept standing on it because he said, I thought, if they haven't signaled Holland what's going on, and I come around in a few laps and get the white flag, and he sees that, he might try to race me. And said, so my strategy then was take the white flag before Holland comes through the turn. And then he said, as far as Moore said, I've got everything wrapped up in those two cars, and they were going to finish first and second regardless, and unless there was a problem. And so Rose said, actually, it would have been more advantageous for Lou Moore to have Holland win, because he said, I was driving for 40%, and Holland wanted the ride so much that he took it for 30%. And so anyway, Holland, who was known to, always sort of had like a little bit of a complex where he thought everybody was out to get him, as successful as he was. I talked to several people that said that even as a young man, he just thought that the world was against him. But instead of blowing up or storming out just going off in a huff, he was smart enough to think, this is one of the best cars here, and I can drive it again next year, which he did. And so Rose won it again with Holland second. And then in 49, Rose broke down trying to catch Holland late in the race, and then Holland went on to win. So if you're keeping score, that's five wins. It was Floyd Roberts in 38, Floyd Davis and Maury Rose in 41, and then Rose in 47 and 48, and Bill Holland in 49. And then in 50, they actually ran four cars. The two front drives were Bill Holland, who finished second in a rain-shortened race. Tony Battenhausen drove the Maury Rose car and was out early. Rose had left the team, by the way. He and Moore got in a dispute after the thing was over, because Moore thought that Rose should have babied along and saved second, and he was still trying to win. And then they had two rear drive cars that finished sixth with Lee Wallard, and George Conner was eighth. Anyway, after that race, Lou Moore put the whole team up for sale, because he was the owner with four race cars at a time when it was not that common to have more than one. And so the two front drives were purchased by Bill Anstead, and Moore went along as the chief mechanic and was with that team in 51 with Dwayne Carter and Tony Battenhausen, and then 52 with they just got one car in the race, and so anyway they actually built a rear drive car for 1953 with Jim Rathman, and they never could get that one going, and then he got involved with NASCAR. In the mid-1950s, there were several 500 drivers, former 500 drivers, that ran NASCAR teams. And there was Peter DiPaolo had a team, and Lou Moore had a team. And he was actually at Atlanta, not the Atlanta that's there now, not the mile and a half, but the old state fairgrounds. Is it Lakewood? I'm having another moment here.
Unfortunately, you're on your own.
It was a 1 mile dirt track with a jungle like lake in the middle, and Lakewood, I think, is what it was called. And I'm still not sure that's right. Anyway, I think it was March or April of 1956, he had a heart attack in the pits, and passed away there. But anyway. The thing is that he had for many, many years the record for the most wins by a car owner with five. And I remember that Roger Penske was interested in that back in the early days. And so he eyed that, knowing that it was a record that could be had. And then, of course, he eventually tied Lou Moore's record, went ahead, doubled it, and traveled it, and he still hasn't finished. But to this day, Lou Moore is still second in terms of wins by a car owner.
And you had it, by the way. It's Lakewood Speedway.
It's Lakewood Speedway,
I found help to get that answer. But Lakewood Speedway, south of Atlanta, in existence until 1979. According to Wikipedia, considered the Indianapolis of the South, as it was located in the largest city in the southern United States, and it held an annual race of the Indy cars.
It was a 1 mile dirt track, and I've got to throw this in. This has got nothing to do with Lou Moore, but just a little bit about that racetrack. It was a 1 mile dirt track, and I don't know that there were even any guardrails. I mean, things were very loose in those days. And there was a hill that went the backstretch. If you were going into turn three to your right, there was a hill that went up in the opposite direction. So anyway, 1948, I think, there's a NASCAR stock car race going on. And there were those that made money on the side by manufacturing liquor and maybe delivering it maybe once in a while. And so a very well-known driver, who was one of many that was involved in that activity, during the race was looking up into the grandstands And most of the people that would go in those days would wear white shirts and hats, and some of them would wear ties. And if you look at the photos, there's a lot of white shirts. Anyway, there was a few suits up there, which indicated that maybe they might be feds. And so the fellow continued the race. And when the race was over, he took the checkered flag. And the word is that he went around turns one and two down the backstretch and then went through the opening in the fence on the backstretch near turn three, turned onto the public road, and went up the hill at a considerable rate of speed.
Hmm. NASCAR Cup races were held at Lakewood Speedway from 51 until 59.
Well,
and
what
became
that,
Cup
that,
races?
Yes, that's retroactive history. Back in those days, it was the Grand National.
Correct, but that's what became the Cup
what
series.
Became
it
Cup,
was the top.
Yes.
Right. NASCAR series
right.
at the time.
But it was
and
the dirt and T-shirts, and a lot of them drove the cars to and from. In fact, there were actually cars that ran in those races that also did deliveries during the week.
And there were, 100 races a season in some cases?
A lot, yes.
Part of the reason why Richard Petty won 200. Part of Smoking the Bandit was filmed there.
Oh, at
Lakewood? Yep.
I never did see that. I gave that one a pass.
According to you haven't seen Smokey and the Bandit. Oh, my. All right. Thank you, Jeff. We're just getting started. More questions for Donald coming up. 317-239-1070. It's the history of the Indianapolis 500 on the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson. Mike in Vernon Hills is next with Donald. Hi, Mike.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Very fine. Thank you.
Good. Hey, Donald, I wonder if you can talk about riding mechanics that may have had multiple victories. In other words, who was like the George Vignotti or A.J. Watson of riding mechanics back in the day?
There were two that rode twice in the winning car. And there was John W. Jigger Johnson, who rode with Louis Schneider in 1931. And then with Wilbur Shaw in 1937. And then the other was Lawson Harris, who was from Indianapolis. He won with Louis Meyer in 1933 and 1936. Jigger Johnson, I'm not sure if he was Indianapolis born or not. He lived here most of his life. And in fact, the nickname Jigger, that was where Jigger Sirois got his name from. Except this is a little complicated. Earl Sirois, who was Jigger's dad, known as Frenchie, named his son, actually, Jigger's name is actually Leon Duray Sirois. And I had to break it gently to Jigger quite a number of years ago. I am Mr. Poop. I've had to tell people stuff that maybe they were surprised to hear. Leon DeRay was actually a made up name. It was George Stewart was actually Leon DeRay's real name, and this has got nothing to do with riding mechanics. So I better pull myself back here. But anyway. The other notable ones were Spider Matlock, who rode with Billy Arnold in 1930 and was a Hollywood stuntman and appeared in several racing films and non-racing films. And then there was L.M. Shorty Barnes, who rode in 1932. 34 was Earl Inversaw, who was a longtime associate of Bill Cummings. In fact, Bill Cummings had one daughter and named her Earlene, and she was actually named for Earl Inversaw. And so the riding mechanics went from 1911, although it wasn't mandatory to carry one in 1911, so Ray Haroon did not. You got a question?
How high up on, for lack of a better term, the pecking order of team mechanics was the riding mechanic? I guess the first question is, how many mechanics were on a typical Indy 500 entry in the 20s and 30s? And was the riding mechanic the number two guy? Was he the chief?
The answer is both. Sometimes he was the chief mechanic, but sometimes there would be somebody that would would not ride and was sort of more like the team manager type. On the other hand, sometimes the riding mechanic and the driver had done most of the work on some of the smaller teams. And then also there was some last-minute assignments. Like, for instance, in 1919, Harry Wilcox won with a Peugeot, and the riding mechanic was Maurice Becker through the whole month, except he was actually a Frenchman who was actually Maurice Becker, but it got Americanized to Maurice Becker. And so a lot of sources will show him as the riding mechanic, and there was actually a last-minute switch. So when you get the photographs from the Photoshop with the driver and riding mechanic and the white riding on the bottom, that's not necessarily the mechanic that rode on race day. And in 1919, there was Maurice Becker's wife kicked up a fuss the night before the race and forbid him to ride. And so that morning, and this sounds like a movie, but that morning he came in and said, look, my wife won't let me ride. And so they had a fellow named Leo Banks who was hanging around. And so they said, all right, kid, you're it. And so he rode in the winning car. And one of the first comments, so when the press were, you know, they pulled into Victory Lane and they're interviewing the driver and the riding mechanic, although normally he didn't get much attention. And the fellow said, well, I've got to let my mother know because she didn't know I was doing this today. But to go back, if you like, Ray Haroon didn't carry one. Joe Dawson carried Harry Martin, who was also the fellow in a great story about riding with the Stutz that was on fire in 1913. But I better not get into that one right now.
We want to make sure we get a third call on.
Well, probably. Okay. Yes, we got to make a third call. Get a third call today. Emile Bégin was the Frenchman that came with Jules Gou. Robert Lallet rode with René Thomar in 1914, and I think we talked about him the other night. He's the amazing fellow to me who rode for the first time at Indianapolis in 14 with Thomar and was in the winning car, and then Europe got involved. So it was 1919 before the Frenchman and the other foreigners were able to come back, including Robert Lallet. And then so their first race back in 1919 was... René Thomas won the pole with a ballo, and Robert Lallet was the riding mechanic. So he rode in 14 to victory, and then 1919 is on the pole. And in the meantime, he'd been a POW. Anyway, 1920, well, so it was, I need to go back. 1915, Ralph De Palma had a driver named Louis Fontaine. And 1916 was Dario Resta, and he had Robert Donkey. And then, as we said, Leo Banks rode with Howdy Wilcox in 19. And then 20 was Gaston Chevrolet with Johnny Bresnahan, who I think was a relative. No, he was not a relative. But the next year, when Tommy Milton won, Henry Frank was the riding mechanic, and he actually was a Chevrolet relative. And then 1922 with Jimmy Murphy and Ernie Olson. Then there were no more riding mechanics till 1930, and it was Spider Matlock with Billy Arnold in 30, Jagger Johnson with Louis Schneider in 31. 32, Fred Frame had Shorty Barnes, Lawson Harris with Louis Meyer in 33, Earl Unvasaw with Bill Cummings in 34. 35 was Jimmy Dunham, who rode with Kelly Patillo. And that's a great story because he was just a young fellow, and I met him, and he only rode in one race in his life. The only race he rode in was the 1935 Indianapolis 500 with Kelly Patillo, and he was in the winning car. And then 36, Lawson Harris with Meyer, and then 37, Jagger Johnson with Wilbur Shaw. But the riding mechanics were very colorful. A number of them became drivers. I think there's 24 people that had a start in the 500 as a driver and as a riding mechanic. And sometimes, and it wasn't necessarily a transition to a riding mechanic becoming a driver. Sometimes it actually happened a couple of times where it was somebody did both in the same race. Myron Stevens in 1931 drove Louis Meyer's own car while Louis drove for Alden Sampson. And when that car dropped out and then Louis Meyer took over the car that he owned, Myron Stevens shifted from the driver's seat over into the riding mechanic seat. And there's photographs to back that one up. And then Thane Hauser, for instance, was a riding mechanic, drove, and then went back to being a riding mechanic. And the last two people who were riding mechanics that drove in, or the last two people that drove in the 500 who had been a riding mechanic, and one was kind of a surprise, Johnny McDowell, who drove in 49, 50, 51, and 52, had been a riding mechanic in the 1937 race, which was the last year that they were required. And then Jimmy Jackson, who was a riding mechanic in 34, 35, 36, and 37, and then drove after the war. And in fact, in 1954, and I told this story somewhere, I don't know if it was on the air or not, but anyway, he was a relief driver in the 1954 race and was running at the end when they flagged everybody in, and he was the last person to drive a lap in competition who had previously been a riding mechanic. But they were a really colorful bunch of people.
All right. Thank you, Mike. More questions for Donald coming up. 107.5 1070 The Fan. The talk of Gasoline Alley continues with Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee. Back to the phones in a moment, but Donald has another point to make.
In talking about colorful, right, I should have been doing more stories on riding mechanics instead of trying to go through all of the winners. But a tip of the hat to Takeo Chiki Hiroshima,
sure.
Who was a Japanese-American born in this country. And he came to the track for the first time in 1935 with Rex Mays and was on the pole. And I think Mays was 22 and Chiki was like 23. They came back and won the pole again. And then in 37, which was the final year for riding mechanics, he'd moved over to the Joel Thorne team and he rode with Jimmy Snyder. And they set 1 and 4 lap track records, but not on the first qualify day. So they were in the back. So he actually rode in the fastest qualifier for three straight years, the only 3 years that he drove. And he was a great little, great little character, and was the winning chief mechanic with Jim Rathman in 1960, and did engine work for a lot of people, and then worked for both Autolite and Champion Spark Plug, and just a great, great character.
Paul in Racine is with us next.
Hi,
Paul. You're up with Donald.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, Donald. I hope you guys had a great weekend.
We did.
Good. Hey, Donald, can you talk about Emo Andres?
Yes.
And can you also talk a little bit in the Bettenhausen book, they talk about how he became like a father figure to the Bettenhausen boys,
yes,
after Tony passed away. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yes. As it turns out, believe it or not, they were related. But nobody could ever tell me exactly why, and because Emil lived in Tinley Park. And so I asked about that one time, and he said, yeah, we were shirt-tail cousins. But I don't know if that means third cousins or what, but they were related somehow. So we'll have to get a genealogist on that to figure it out. But so that would be one of the reasons why he was always there. Emil Andres was a very interesting guy because he came across as being very gruff and as a driver and as an official. And he was really a great guy. I don't know that the 500 had a greater fan, if you like, among the participants, unless it was Duke Nalen. And the two of them were very good friends, rather different personalities, but just fans of the event from the time they were boys before they were ever driving in it. And so Emil, in fact, his nickname was Cuz, C-U-Z, Cuz. And I wonder if that was something to do with the fact that he was related to the Bettenhausers. I never thought about that until right now. But Anyway, his Emio's best 500 finish was fourth in 1946 with the Elgin Piston Pin Special, which was a Maserati. And after he retired as a driver, he went up through, his tenure was 1936 through 1950 was the last year that he tried to qualify. He was the head of the stock car division. He was the chief steward, if you like, or the supervisor for the USAC stock car circuit for quite a number of years. He was a great person to talk to just about history because of the fact that he had, you know, spent time with people that were long before my time, and but he knew them. And so I was always interested in talking, you know, because, golly, Duke actually roomed with Floyd Roberts at one time. And I thought, you know, I'm just sort of blessed that I can talk to these fellows, mm-hmm. and they can tell you from firsthand what some of these other drivers were like. But as far as when the Bettenhausen accident happened, that was the day before the first qualifying day in 1961. And Tony Bettenhausen had this car that looked like not only was it going to win the pole, but it was just within a blink of running 150 miles an hour in practice. Jack Beckley was the chief mechanic. And Paul Russo was a longtime friend of Tony Bettenhausen, and in fact had spent the winter on Bettenhausen's farm in Tindley Park. He was a soybean farmer. And so Russo was driving the 59 winning car, but it wasn't running very well. And so Tony agreed to take it for what they knew, they called a test hop, and then had this part malfunctioned. I won't go into that, but it got up on the wall and rolled end over end, and tore down all the fencing. And so Jack Beckley was the one that made the call to Valerie Bettenhausen, who's the mother of Gary, Merle, and Tony. And then there was also a daughter, Susie. And Jack would have tears in his eyes when he talked that he had to make the call because, you know, Tony Bettenhausen just figured that he was indestructible. And here he was sort of nearing the end of his career, and it looked like he was going to be able to win the pole and maybe the race. And he called up and he said, Val, it's Tony. And he said, there's been an accident. So she said, is he hurt? And he said, all the way. And so immediately a lot of, the racing fraternity came together, and certainly Emio would have been very much a part of that. And I never thought about him. I never thought until you asked the question, Paul, about his relationship with Gary and Merle and little Tony. But I would think it was probably, he was very fatherly towards them. I know that Tony Bettenhausen Sr. apparently was quite a disciplinarian and quite strict with the boys growing up, or at least Gary and Merle, not Tony, little Tony so much, Tony Lee. But anyway, I don't know really how to wind this one up, except that I really enjoyed spending time with Emio Landreas because he was funny and spoke in, you know, he would do mock, Chicago tough guy accents and little mafia just for a joke. But he was just a terrific source for the days when he was driving and also the days before he was driving, because he would come to the event as a teenager, as a spectator.
Paul, thank you. Let's sneak in Steve. We have 2 minutes, so if we need to finish up tomorrow night, we will. Go ahead, Steve.
All right,
maybe
we'll
can get you done.
Hey, Donald, how are you?
Fine, Steve. You got a quickie?
Yesterday, I was visiting with a lady that came to the Speedway with Tony Hallman, who said she met you when you first came to Indy. And her name is June Swango.
Oh, June Swango? Was that, you were with her?
I was with her yesterday.
But not at the track?
No.
Okay. She's in a retirement home.
She's in a retirement home. Yep, yes, she is.
I need to go see her. She was Tony Holman's secretary for many years, and she headed up credentials, which was a very different setup in those days. And she was extremely good to me. And I've thought for years, people have said, you should go see her. And I didn't really want to impose, not knowing, you know, I mean, she's really getting along now, but I will follow up on that. And I'm very, very flattered that that she would remember me after all these years.
Oh, yeah, she remembers you. She said she picked you up at the airport.
I know she got me a flight one time because that's a whole nother story. I don't remember her picking me up at the airport.
Okay.
She arranged for somebody to take me to the airport when I had missed a flight, and that's a long story. And maybe I'll do that story on another night. It involves Greyhound and then a frantic rush out to Weirkirk.
Well, rest assured, she still remembers you, and she speaks very highly of you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I do need to go see her.
Thank you, Steve. We'll try again tomorrow night, 8 o'clock. We thank you, Donald. We look forward to being at the racetrack tomorrow. Weather permitting, and the forecast is getting better and better. We hope to see cars on track tomorrow. 11 a.m. is when it starts, and veterans are eligible right at the beginning tomorrow until 6 o'clock. That's the schedule throughout the week, and then qualifying on Saturday and Sunday. Indy 500 now on IndyCar.com at 10:45 tomorrow morning with myself and Bob Jenkins. So look forward to that tomorrow. Thanks for joining us on 1070 The Fan.